So I really wanted to start by just making a few notes in general, and to sort of whet your appetite, as I said, a little bit, by saying essentially that astrophysical fluids, which will be essentially the focus of this lecture course, they are really everywhere. Astrophysical fluids really penetrate the universe. They are ubiquitous on all scales. You can think of the smaller scales that we know of are essentially planets, and maybe you might be thinking about sort of the dust rings of Saturn, but it really goes all the way to the very large scales, to the biggest scales we know of, to the scales of the universe and the evolution of the universe as a whole. And essentially, just to point out a few exciting examples where we encounter astrophysical fluids. As I said, on all scales, you can start with, they are everywhere in solar and stellar physics. So here on the left, you see actually, I think, a very exciting observation, recent observation by the GREGOR telescope, solar telescope. It's one of the leading solar telescopes right now, showing a sunspot on our sun, the star nearest to us. And it's fascinating in what detail we can resolve here, and we can actually watch astrophysical fluids move. So that's one very exciting example from solar and stellar astrophysics. Another system that's of great interest right now is tidal disruption events, for example, where essentially a star flies in and gets tidally disrupted in the gravitational field of stellar mass black hole or even a supermassive black hole, giving rise to an accretion disk that eventually results in electromagnetic emission that we can observe through telescopes on across essentially the electromagnetic spectrum. Going essentially to the next system of great interest are neutron star mergers these days, and the reasons are obvious to you. We can observe them through gravitational waves by gravitational wave detectors like LIGO, Virgo, and recently Kagra, the Japanese detector, also joined. That is a very exciting field that is of great interest to many of us here in the strong gravity group at Perimeter. And again, here, fluids are crucial for sort of the theoretical interpretation of such systems. And you can move up scales essentially to supernovae and the interaction with the interstellar medium. Here on top, you see an observation of the supernova, of a supernova remnant, the Crab Nebula. At the center, you see the pulsar that you actually don't see, but there is a pulsar that's left over from the supernova explosion. And what you see here is very complicated hydrodynamics, where essentially the gas ejector, the outflows from the supernova explosion interact with the interstellar medium and give rise to these pulsar wind nebulae. And then the interstellar medium itself is actually of great interest, and there is actually a complicated hydrodynamics phenomena here. You can see star-forming regions and with all their complexity. There's also very interesting radiation hydrodynamics problems there. And so you can move up the ladder up to full cosmological simulations. And that is really all to say that astrophysical fluids really play a central role in understanding how our universe works. It's really the sort of building block of many, many astrophysical and cosmological problems. And that means that we need to understand the equations that govern these dynamics, which are the equations of hydrodynamics. And so we'll be focusing on this a lot during this lecture course. There's additional ingredients, obviously, that complicate the problem a lot. There's gravity, obviously, that can be dealt with in various ways in a Newtonian fashion or in a GR version. And there's all sorts of other additional physics that we usually collectively label as microphysics. And really what we mean by this is that there's aspects of chemistry, so there are chemical reactions going on, especially in the interstellar medium and so on. There's aspects of nuclear and atomic physics everywhere, there are electromagnetic fields, and so on and so forth, and they all add up to the sort of inherent complexity of many astrophysical systems. And the other point that I wanted to point out is that essentially the way in which we receive and which we probe the universe and these astrophysical systems is really via electromagnetic radiation. And that, as you know, is being reprocessed as it travels towards us, either by the emitting system itself through reabsorption or by reprocessing in the interstellar or intergalactic medium. And so we do also need to understand the equations of radiation transport and so how radiation is actually being transmitted to us. And so the equations of radiation transport will also play a role in many of these computational problems, and we'll also discuss them in this course to some extent. Now, I should also mention that obviously we have, since a few years, at least now, we have also different messengers. We now can also probe the universe via gravitational waves, as I already mentioned. That's really, and so we're really entering an exciting era where we get complementary information through gravitational waves. But there are also other messengers like high energy particles, so high energy neutrinos or high energy cosmic rays that also probe astrophysical systems. And so this is what we collectively label as multi-messenger astrophysics, and I would also count myself as one of the doing research in this very exciting area. Now, we've talked here a little bit about astrophysical fluids and the basic building blocks. Now, simulations come in when we essentially try to interpret astrophysical or astronomical observations, rather. And typically, the way that one approaches this astronomical observations is, the theoretical interpretation of astronomical observations is through various stages of theoretical refinement. Usually, what one will do is to start with crude analytic estimates that give you a order of magnitude understanding of the problem. That's what it's typically called these back of the envelope calculations that at least give you some rough idea or a rough interpretation of what might be happening in a given system, and that usually trigger more detailed calculations on the semi-analytic level, where we write down some of the basic evolution equations, but make simplifying assumptions and a lot of approximations to try to handle things in a little more complex way. So to to essentially reflect the increasing increasing complex nature of astronomical observations. So as more and more observations come in, typically phenomena get more complex, and so they require to go beyond these analytic estimates. But eventually also the semi-analytical calculations may not be accurate enough to cover all the complexity that we see. And so this is where we really enter the regime of full-scale numerical simulations. And that is often like a battleground for test hypotheses and to test claims that have been previously made. Sometimes you discover entirely new phenomena also with this. So it's also a bottom-up approach. I tend to think of these numerical simulations sometimes like as a laboratory. So as a laboratory for numerical experiments. So there's an important distinction in astrophysics between observations and experiment that we have in all the other fields of physics, essentially. But in astronomy or astrophysics, we only have observations, and we have to be lucky to see something interesting that may tell us about something more deep, something deeper in these systems and about the physics that is going on there. But it's not reproducible. Observations are essentially all unique. And what such a full-scale numerical simulation provides us is essentially something like a laboratory where we can do numerical experiments. So I think of as someone in a lab who's preparing samples and does study changing different parameters and asking certain questions to nature by systematically approaching it, hoping to find a good answer. We can do essentially the same with a supercomputer, where we, you know, set up a suite of numerical experiments, of numerical simulations, where we also try to essentially set up an answer and get and hopefully get something interesting back. And in doing so, we can achieve quite amazing things, I would say. So one sort of area that fascinates me a lot in this context, on this note, is essentially, again, coming back to solar physics, is the level of detail with which we can actually reproduce conditions on the surface of the sun, of our closest star. So one, I think, very exciting example for that is here shown on the left, where you see essentially patterns on the photosphere of the sun, on the surface of the sun, called granulations, or these are these convective motions on the surface of the sun. On the right-hand side, you see a fully numerical simulation, actually radiative hydrodynamic simulation of this surface convection of the granulation pattern. And if you sort of convolve this with the resolution that is available for observations, you'll end up with something shown here in the middle. And it's quite striking how close the observed and the theoretically predicted patterns are. And so this is, I would say, one fascinating example of how you can sort of reproduce some astrophysical systems in the lab of a supercomputer. Now, obviously, here we can observe things very closely because the sun is really close to us, and we have a spatially resolved system. But in other astrophysical systems, that's not really the case. And one example here is so if this was now the keynote presentation, there would be a movie actually, which I can't show to you now, but you can watch it later. Obviously, I will make all these materials available to you. And what you would see here is the merger of two neutron stars simulation we ran some time ago that shows you how we can actually model such a collision in a supercomputer and actually learn about the dynamics and all the very complicated physics that is going on in these mergers. And in this case, really, we will never be able to observe the dynamics with such detail. So this is a fundamentally different example to solar granulation, for example. So here, the neutron star mergers, these simulations are really the only way to resolve, to actually spatially resolve the dynamics of the merger process itself. And then finally, again, there would be a nice movie that takes us on a flight through the universe, showing this a large-scale cosmological simulation. And so, yeah, we can even sort of simulate the cosmic web here. So this is to say simulations can really achieve amazing things, but, and here comes the big but, I do numerical simulations myself, but I would always sort of advocate for healthy skepticism. Simulations are also not perfect. Simulations are still approximate. We hope to, you know, get as close as possible to sort of reality, but there's still approximations involved. And additionally, there are numerical problems and numerical effects that are not reflected by the actual equations that describe the dynamics of the system. So there can be numerical instabilities, for example, that can spoil the convergence. There are other numerical effects, or say numerical features, if you want to put it proper, sort of positively, of certain numerical schemes that have to be taken into account. And so all results one usually gets from simulations have to be treated with caution and have to be sort of carefully validated. And that sort of kind of closes this loop and brings us back to analytical estimates or semi-analytical calculations. So then in the end, there are intrinsic ways of how to verify that numerical results are valid and numerical results are accurate, so that we actually converge to a physical solution. But then sometimes this is not entirely possible. And then you have to resort again to order of magnitude estimate or to additional calculations, simplified calculations, to convince yourself that what you actually see with the simulation actually makes sense and describes what you think may reflect reality out there. So I would really think of this as a closed loop where essentially all these stages are necessary and sometimes work together in a sort of iterative way. Now, let's get to formalities. So I'm told by credible social scientists that expectations of expectations, so the fact that we have expectations about other people's expectations actually reduces complexity and provides stability to a social system. So let's talk about expectations for this course. We all may go into this course with sort of different thoughts in mind, and I just wanted to set out a few things fairly clear from the beginning. So you may have seen the sort of official course outline that's posted on the university policies, and everything is on there, and I would encourage you to take a look. There is a course website already, which I put on GitHub as a GitHub repository, essentially. This is where I'm going to post all the lecture course materials. So this includes the slides as the ones that we are looking at right now. But those will also contain some of the problem sets that will be there for you to work on. And they will also contain the lecture notes eventually. Lecture notes will not be typed this time. They will be handwritten. So I'll make them available there as PDFs for you to take a look. And since there's sort of no typed lecture notes, I would encourage you, if you want to take notes yourself. Most of what we're going to do will be essentially Blackboard style. So usually if we were not in the midst of a pandemic, these would be, and I will replace that by a whiteboard, by a digital whiteboard, which is my iPad. And we'll continue on the iPad in just a little bit. And so in general, I encourage you to take your own handwritten notes. Just to point out, there will be problem sets for you to work on to keep up with some of the things that we discuss here. And they will be of different types. There will be, you know, classical analytic problems for you to work on, a few things to prove and to show. And I will try to make them as useful as possible, meaning that they will cover mostly complementary material to what we do here in the course, simply because we don't have the time to do everything. And so these are things where you can sort of explore complementary things, but also understand some, but at the same time also understand some of the concepts that we discuss here more deeply and in a better way. But in addition to these sort of classical problem sets, there will be also a practical component, so sort of a project component, if you want. And those will be sort of hands-on exercises for you to implement a few things, because this course is essentially a computational course. So we discuss a lot sort of the theory behind numerical schemes and these kind of things. But at the same time, I think it's very instructive and useful to actually practically implement some of the results and some of the algorithms that we'll be discussing. So this will be just a very different way of you to get a better understanding of the course material. And so what I have in mind here is for you to check out a few finite differencing schemes for partial differential equations. We'll be discussing this in the following weeks. And so some of them are really easy to implement. And you can explore some of their numerical properties. So these are exactly the sort of features or deficiencies I was alluding to earlier. So you can sort of explore on the one hand so how powerful some of these methods are, but at the same time also what their limitations are and where one has to be thinking. And this will also be sort of relevant to sort of more broadly relevant, not just to hydrodynamics, but also to other partial differential equations. So some of us here are interested in the Einstein equations and numerical relativity. And so you can directly transfer these concepts to the Einstein equations, for example, as well. Another aspect I'd like to work you on is to write actually a Riemann solver for the Euler equations. It turns out this is not a very hard, difficult task to do. And it's a fundamental building block of any modern sort of hydrodynamics code, be it in astrophysics or cosmology or elsewhere. So this will be, I think, also very important to work on. And finally, you can combine this by a modern enough type scheme, which is essentially the basic scheme of most sort of modern hydrodynamics codes. And that, again, as I said, takes a Riemann solver as a core input and then iterates on that. So this will be another exercise for you to work on at some point in a few, sort of few weeks from now. For those of you who take this course for credit, there will also be a final exam, and date and time will still be need to be determined. You'll see the grading scheme here is essentially 30% homework, and the rest is. So as for the concepts, what to expect? So this is essentially sort of a broad outline. I've sent around more detailed outline via email, and you'll also find a more detailed outline on the GitHub website. So what I have in mind is to start essentially with just some very basic definitions and properties of partial differential equations. So just to make sure that we are all on the same page. And that will already introduce some interesting concepts that we're working, that we'll need later on, like hyperbolic systems and domain of determinancy and range of influence and some of these concepts. We'll then move on to discuss essentially the basic equations of computational fluid dynamics. So we'll discuss the Euler equations, we'll discuss magneto hydrodynamics, we'll discuss a little bit radiation transport, and we'll move all of that from Newtonian to relativistic, to the relativistic setting. And so after having essentially discussed some of these sort of analytic concepts, we'll turn to the first numerical chapter, which will be on finite differencing methods for PDEs. And that will be very general, as I mentioned. We'll learn finite differencing schemes and how to implement them. And that should be sort of useful for all sorts of, you know, PDE problems where finite differencing is applicable. So in particular, the Einstein equations, some of, you know, as I couldn't show the movie actually, but the space-time evolution, for example, for the neutron star merger that you can look, you can watch there, is actually done with finite differencing. So it's actually being used in current research. And we'll then turn back on some sort of more theoretical background when we start to discuss conservation laws, so a specific type of PDE, which is the related problems. And they have very special properties and bring some additional complexity, which we need to think carefully about, because that influences the way that numerical schemes have to be designed in order to make sure we get the right solution to these equations. So there will be a rather long chapter on the theoretical mathematical background of conservation laws. We'll then discuss, or say apply this in more detail directly to the Euler equations, just to highlight how that looks like in a sort of more concrete setting rather than sort of the more abstract and general setting. And then we turn to the sort of chapter 6, where we'll then discuss specifically numerical schemes for conservation laws. We're then well equipped with all the theoretical background to discuss those. And at the core of these schemes, we have Riemann solvers. So I have discussed in more detail Riemann solvers and how we use them in computational hydrodynamics. And that brings us to approximate Riemann solvers. In particular, Rose Riemann solver and the HLL family of Riemann solvers. You've probably heard of those. They appear essentially in every hydrodynamics code. So we'll go through through those and how they simplify the problem. And then finally, we make the modifications going from conservation laws to balance laws. So we're going to add source terms and also higher spatial dimensions to see how we can generalize these schemes to sort of the more realistic setting of a 3D space where we also we have source terms on the right-hand side of these equations. And then finally, if time allows, I'll venture into a primer on discontinuous Galerkin methods, which is a somewhat different approach to solving the hydrodynamics equations. And it's been coming in focus more and more over the last couple of years. And so for those of you who are sort of more numerically inclined, you'll encounter this as you venture into more research in that area. So it should hopefully be useful to those of you, but also to everyone else, obviously. Okay, as references, I have listed here a few books that you might want to check out. Essentially, what I'm going to do is essentially sort of distilled knowledge of sort of several different areas. So I will combine essentially, you know, some elements of applied mathematics, but with physics and astrophysics. And sort of this combination is hard to find in just one single textbook. So so I listed here a few books that that sort of roughly cover essentially the spectrum, and that range a nice book by Toro on Riemann solvers and numerical methods for fluid dynamics. And obviously Levesque's book on finite volume methods for hyperbolic problems are available as PDFs through university library. There's more mathematically inclined, and especially I also offer from this book by Gruner on titled Numerical Schemes for Conservation Laws, which is very nice in terms of the mathematical detail that it contains. I also recommend this book by Evans on partial differential equations, which is just on the analytic level, but I think contains a nice treatment of the Riemann problem. And so I'll also draw from this at some point. And then there's other useful books. Anil, for example, Relativistic Fluids and Magnetofluids is a nice treatment of on the analytic level. I also like this book on numerical methods in astrophysics, which is very concise, has covers a broad range of topics and is very concise, but contains a lot of, I think, useful. And also there's also on financing methods, and partial differential equations, that is also sort of useful background material for, I think, chapter 3 or so. So I'll encourage you to read a little bit in some of those books. Most of them you will find on the university website. And if you can find, if you really want to check out some of these books and you don't find a PDF or so, let me know and I'm happy to make those available, or we can find a way of making those available. So as I said, we're going to do some coding at some point. Please, as a sort of first homework, if you want, not graded, obviously, please try to familiarize yourself with Python a little bit. So what I would sort of ask you to do is, for those of, at least of you who have not used Python before, to sort of install Python on your laptop or computer. I'm sure and I know that many of you have and know how to use and code in Python. but some of you may not. And so please take a moment over the next couple of days to look into this. There's all sorts of easy tutorials on the web on how to do this if you haven't done it yet. Also, if you need help, please contact me. I'm more than happy to provide some guidance on how to do this. And the second point is also that for those of you who are not familiar with Git repositories or, and for example, GitHub, platforms like GitHub, also please take a moment to familiarize yourself with that. That's not really required for this course, but it may be useful for you. Having a Git repository or version control system is very important when doing coding to make sure that all the versions get registered and you have a log of changes and everything, and you can go back and forth in your history between different versions. So I can definitely recommend looking into this, and also I'm more than happy to provide some guidance on this if you encounter problems here. And then finally, the last point is office hours. Obviously, if you want to discuss topics of the course sort of more personally and in greater detail, I'm more than happy to chat. Those will be again virtually, sort of by virtue of the situation right now. For now, I haven't scheduled an actual date or time yet. So we'll see how the demand is. I'm happy to schedule something more regularly if people are interested. Otherwise, I would keep it on a sort of on-demand basis where you just email me and we can set up a day and time to talk about, you know, course content or homework or any of this. Are there any questions so far? No questions. Okay. Okay, or any concerns? Let me actually stop sharing this. Okay.
I have a question. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
I was just wondering, could we potentially use Julia as, just because, I mean, I haven't really used Julia much. I was thinking it would be a good way to practice instead of Python.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to, that's a question. So Julia, I don't know if you're all familiar with this, is of a new language or sort of new language, which is nice and offers sort of many advantages over Python in terms of speed, at least for some applications, sort of like linear algebra examples for you. Because it essentially works as fast as C code or Fortran, so as a like a compiled code, but then on the other hand is very easy to use like Python, like an interpreted language. So I mean, if you want to work in Julia, that's perfectly fine with me, and you can obviously do these exercises in Julia. That's up to you. For all the rest of you, for those who want to use Python, that's fine too. I think either of them is fine. I'll leave it up to you to experiment with this. If you want to take this as a chance to also get more familiar with Julia, I think that's absolutely a great idea. I think you're welcome to do that. Okay. Does that roughly answer your question? So I might, you know, make available some solutions to these numerical experiments so that you can, you know, also compare your own code with what I provide. But that would most likely be in Python.
Hi, Daniel. So I have a question. Yeah. So can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
So we are using Python. So which version of Python do we use? So you know, there's sometimes a big difference between the Python 2 and 3.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't want to like impose a standard. I'm happy with, you know, whatever you're happy with. The important thing is that, you know, if you code something and at least for those of you who want to do it for credit, it's important that in the end, you know, it works and I can, you know, I can create different environments here to check your code and to check, you know, whether it's working or not. So for me, it's not a big problem. I would appreciate if you can do it in Python 3, you know, if you want to work in Python 2.7 or something, that's fine with me. Also that is up to you, whatever you feel a little more comfortable with. I mean, the differences between the two Python standards is not huge. So in case you're working with sort of an older version, it may also be a good, maybe sort of a good excuse to move to a new version and try some easy coding in Python 3, for example.
Okay, so thank you.
Sure. Okay, any other questions before we start? If not, I would just start essentially with our first chapter. And so as I mentioned, this will be mostly now, we'll switch also to slides at some other point during the lectures, but at least, you know, for the more sort of mathematical or sort of more formal parts, I'll stick to my iPad and essentially a Blackboard lecture. I hope you can all see my iPad screen now. Let's start here with chapter one.
Daniel, it looks kind of weird,
yes?
Like very long rather than wide. I don't know if that's on purpose.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like we're only seeing like a quarter of the thing.
Oh,
yeah, it's very skinny on my screen too.
Huh, interesting. Is that better?
Yeah, that's better.
Is it now? Do you see the full thing?
Yeah, I see the full thing now.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, I don't know why sometimes it cuts the screen for some reason. It's probably maybe because I have multiple screens here and some of the video signal gets cut for some reason. Seems to be a bug in Zoom or so. Please let a second.
Can you repeat what book we're starting in the of the list that you showed us?
So yeah, as I mentioned, so I'm not following one single textbook. So there will be not the one single reference for this course. So rather what we're going to do is essentially a compilation. So I'm drawing from various different areas and I'm trying to provide you with a course with a focus from someone who's doing sort of numerical methods, but also astrophysics. And so this will have a particular focus, this course. And due to the sort of interdisciplinary nature of the course, there's unfortunately not a single textbook that I can point you to. So what's going to be most important are obviously the lecture notes. So all the things that we're going to develop here essentially on the Blackboard or say on the iPad. And so I will make those notes available to you. In terms of textbooks, I would, if you want sort of a more general reference to the course, I would suggest the first two. They are also highlighted on the course outline on the website. So this is Toro's book and Levesque's book. under sort of this category I labeled numerical methods. So I think they provide sort of the most easiest, sort of most straightforward introduction to some of the numerical methods here. They are a little bit short on, you know, on the sort of mathematical foundation of this, which, you know, you would have to read up in some of the other books I listed there. But at least in terms of comprehensiveness, they sort of cover a broad range of the numerical methods that we're going to discuss here.
Right, when you just write chapter one, you don't mean a chapter in a book. You're just essentially like the first chapter in your lectures.
Exactly. So this is our chapter one.
Okay, gotcha.
It's going to chapter one. So you'll see the outline. On all of the slides, you can look it up on the GitHub repository after this lecture, and so you'll find all essentially the listing of all the chapters and the corresponding topics there, and that doesn't follow any particular book. Okay. So I don't know how much everyone has sort of dealt with partial differential equations. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, in this first chapter, as we set out the foundations for all that is to come, that we cover some, you know, very basic definitions to make sure we... So let's start with partial differential equations of second order. And let's first make a few basic definitions and define a little bit of notation. So let's say we are in Rn, some point in Rn x, and let's consider two regions in Rn. And then we define a differential operator, which is a mapping between spaces of functions on these subsets. So let's call L a differential operator. And so you can think of this, for example, as, you know, you plug in some differentiable function, you apply the differential operator to it, and what you get in the end is maybe a continuous function on this subset omega 2, and obviously omega 1 or omega 2 can be Rn itself. So if we look at such a function u that maps from omega 1 to omega 2, we'll use the following notation for partial derivatives, namely this index xi, will just denote the partial derivative with respect to this coordinate direction xi. And then corresponding, the second order derivatives will be denoted in this way. So it's the second derivative with respect to xi and xj. Okay. So with this notation, let's write down the first very basic definition, and that's the classification of second order partial differential equations. So the most general category of these equations are what we call nonlinear PDEs. And obviously, so they can be written of this type, L operating on u equals zero, where L is a the main pan on the second derivatives. And at least some coefficients of the second derivatives are non-zero, so that we actually have second order derivatives in this operator. So for at least one pair of indices, we should retain some terms in here. So as a just simple example, okay, let's say omega 1, omega 2 is Rn, or say even R2, make it even simpler, then for example, we can write down such a one very easy nonlinear equation would be of this type. Where you see the nonlinear term here, obviously, where we have this mixed derivative squared, which makes it nonlinear. Okay, the second type. Now we are sort of reducing complexity, is what's called quasi-linear PDEs. And so these are of the following form. Let's imagine we have some coefficients here, aij, that may depend on x on this on the Poisson space, on the solution u itself, and on the first derivatives, but not on the second derivatives, meaning that this differential operator is linear in the second derivatives, but it may be nonlinear in the first order derivatives. So this and this B term here is also captures some of the sort of collectively some terms that we later will identify as source terms of the equation. So a simple example here is, again, let's take these two regions between which we have mappings as Rn, and then let's say we have this type of equation. And this is actually an equation some of you may have come across earlier at some point. This is actually an equation you encounter if you compute minimal surfaces. So functions that satisfy this differential equation actually minimize the area functional. So no, just as simpler are semi-linear partial differential equations. By the way, can you actually read my handwriting or so one challenge with this is also that I have to learn to write really quick and yet readable on an iPad. And so this is also a learning process for me. So please let me know if you can't read my handwriting or if you have any requests in that regard.
I had a question.
Okay.
In the nonlinear PDE, you said that we need to have one pair of indices giving us a cross derivative term to introduce nonlinearity. So is that the only way we introduce nonlinearity, or can there be like other terms also which, let's say like I've seen sine terms or cosine terms. So
yeah, so the only...
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, so for the nonlinear part, so that's the most general category. And so the only thing that we are requiring here is that it contains, second order derivatives. And so that is sort of so in particular, these second order derivatives can appear in nonlinear terms, as this example shows. So let me scroll up here. So in particular, we allow terms this type where these second order derivatives, come in powers or in other combinations. So this is just the sort of most general class you can think of. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay. So moving on to semilinear equations. So the next simplification we can do is to write down the following, where we have this type. And so now we don't allow this the coefficients of the second order terms here to depend on any derivatives anymore. So one simple example here is, for example, minus sort of Laplace u, and then we have actually some nonlinear first order term here. So this sort of corresponds to this part here, where we still allow nonlinearity in the first order terms. And then finally, category that we will deal with a lot is linear partial differential equations. And so those can be written in the following way, where LU equals some ij on n over some coefficients aij. And so we have some linear terms here. And so one simple example of this type is simply the Laplace equation, for example. Okay, so these are just a very basic classification. So let me just make a quick remark here. So if we are looking for a differentiable solution, so a solution U of C2, then we can assume that these coefficients ij are symmetric, and that's because the partial second order derivatives, partial derivatives commute for differentiable functions. So this means that matrix aij is symmetric and has therefore real eigenvalues. Okay, and that brings me to the next definition, also a basic definition to set out the scene here. So let's say we're at some point in Rn, let's say that we have lambda 1 to lambda n as the real eigenvalues of this matrix A that summarizes all the coefficients of the second order terms. And then let's assume that, you know, we count those eigenvalues and we classify them according to the following criterion. So let's say we count the number of negative eigenvalues and we count the number of vanishing eigenvalues, then we can make the following classification. So for this differential operator, again, we're looking here at the linear operator again. So we have all this, all these terms you remember from above. And so we call this differential operator elliptic. When D vanishes, meaning there are no vanishing eigenvalues, and additionally, that T equals zero or T equals N. So either there are only positive or negative eigenvalues. We call this operator hyperbolic. When again, we have no vanishing eigenvalues, but we have at least one negative or n minus one. Actually, if T is anywhere in between 2 and n minus 2, it's called ultra hyperbolic, but this should not be of interest here. And finally, we call it parabolic if there are vanishing eigenvalues in this matrix. So again, this is just a basic definition. Let me just make a few points here. This classification, as you've seen, only depends on the location. So things can change their character as you go from one point in space to the other point in space. So that's in principle allowed, and that's actually a huge source of complexity for numerical schemes if you encounter such a problem. So that classification depends on location. And for quasi-linear PDEs, so if we move to sort of more complex PDEs, then this classification also depends on the solution. And that is also sort of very difficult to handle. We'll sort of discuss a little bit of that later on in the course. And secondly, the classification only depends on the second order terms. And so this is what we call the principal part. And you may have wondered, so for those of you who have never seen this, I just wanted to illustrate this real quick. The reason why actually we call this elliptic, hyperbolic, and parabolic, there's a nice geometric interpretation to this. So we can diagonalize this matrix A. So we can do a coordinate transformation. Where D is a diagonal matrix that has all these eigenvalues of A on the diagonal. And so for this matrix C, we also have that this is one, okay. And so let's consider the quadratic form of the following type. Let's call this Q of psi, which is psi transpose A. Components as ij, ci, cj, which in other words is cd, c star, psi dot psi. And let's just add some unity matrices here. Right, then we can also write this. Okay, I'm probably doing this now too detailed. The idea being that you can transform this into the following form, where we just have, where we've essentially diagonalized this quadratic form. We can call Q tilde of eta, where eta is simply this transformed vector psi. Okay. And so this is essentially known in physics, as you know, as the principal axis theorem. So we've diagonalized this quadratic form. And now the geometric interpretation of these PDEs becomes obvious if we look at level sets of this quadratic form. So if we consider these level sets n, meaning all eta in Rn, where this diagonalized form equals constant, okay? And so this will become now obvious if we look at the simple example where, let's say we're just in the plane, so n is 2, we're in R2, then these level sets are just all vectors in the plane for which lambda 1 eta 1 squared plus lambda 2 eta 2 squared equals constant. And so depending on, you know, the sign of the eigenvalues as we define them here, we now may have different cases. So these level sets may take different forms. So there's the elliptic case where we have, say, both eigenvalues larger than 0. And so you'll recognize, then you can sort of write this as, let me just use a different color here. eta 1 squared over constant over lambda 1 plus eta 2 squared over lambda. And so now let's use a different color here, a squared plus eta 2 over b squared. And so this equals 1, and you'll recognize that this is an ellipse. So the level sets are ellipses in the plane, and hence the name elliptical equation. So this is our level set M. And so you'll find actually A here and B here, right? Okay, so that's interesting. And then similar for all the other cases, I will just briefly write them down here. For the hyperbolic case, we have say 1 greater than lambda 1 greater than 0 and lambda 2 smaller than 0. And then we can write this as eta 1 squared over a squared minus eta 2 squared over b squared, where equals 1. And we'll see that this is the equation of a hyperbola, the basic hyperbola. So level sets will look something like this. Surprise, we find that level sets are essentially degenerated parabolas. So here we have, say, lambda 1 greater than 0, and then lambda 2 is our vanishing eigenvalue. And so here, we get actually lambda 1 eta 1 squared equals some constant, and that's actually a degenerate parabola. So you can actually get a real parabola if you take sort of the into account. So if we say took into account the first order derivatives, you could get something on the order that looks like something like this, and that would be an actual parabola. So you could solve for something like just the other way around. Okay, so this is just as a sort of side remark for where essentially this terminology comes from. Now let's discuss the principal types of equations here. So it turns out that with such a coordinate transformation, we can always transform any second order linear partial differential operator into one of three principal types. So this is also useful to know. So whenever you're given a partial differential equation, you can by applying along the ideas that I've sketched here already. So for simplicity, let's assume that we have constant coefficients for now, and we again consider the following coordinate transformation. So here we have this principal part, Aij, and then the second order derivatives. And so let's apply the coordinate transformation as above. Sorry, I should maybe write this as Cik lambda k C star kj, and then so this is just in component form where we have expressed A as Cd C star. And so just sort of reshuffling this a little bit, write this in the following way. Derivatives here, and then we have these coefficients Cik, Djk, and so now we can sort of define new variables V of y. Okay, I apologize. I'm doing this very explicitly here. This is not really strictly required, but just wanted to point out these things as explicit as possible. So you can define sort of this new variable. You compute what the first order derivative is, what the second order derivative is. That is straightforward to do. And then you'll recognize that these are actually the second order derivatives in these new coordinates. So we can write this as some k1 to n lambda k, and then the second order derivatives in these new coordinates, where y is defined through this relation here. And so we can always write the principal part of any second order linear PDE in this way. Now again, let's look at this for the three different cases, depending on what these eigenvalues are. So for the elliptic case, zero, and these new where y equals square root of d y tilde. And you can define those in this way. Okay, so this is my n tilde. Sorry, this is the eigenvalue. My I tilde. And so if you plug this in, yk tilde of y tilde. So if we just look at the second order part in these new variables, we can transform its eigenvalue is lambda k away. So yk of square root of lambda 1. So this is something, you know, you can go through in more detail on your own. Just wanted to briefly point this out here. It's a little tedious to write this this down. Essentially, this is all of this is to say that by applying this transformation, you know, we can end up with an equation that looks like this. And this is sometimes we may also just add a source term on the right hand side, and this is Poisson equation. So in the elliptic case, we can always transform. So the essential conclusion from this exercise is we can always transform the principal part into something that looks very simple. Equation. And won't do this here. It just follows the same approach, the same spirit. And so you can do this yourself, or read it up in the lecture notes. So for the hyperbolic case, if we're in this scenario, we can always transform the principal part into that, into a simpler, more simple equation that looks like this, is of the type box U. This type, which is the linear wave equation. Okay. And then again, following the same recipe in the parabolic case, where say lambda 1 is 0 and all the other eigenvalues are positive, you'll find that again, we have a term that is Laplace U, but only in Rn minus 1. So this only contains the second derivatives of all indices. So I is simply 2 to n. And then if you take, again, the lower order terms, the first order terms, the first order derivative terms into account, you can have a term that looks like first order derivative in with respect to, can say, use it to a prototype equation of this type. And this is known as another prototype of second order PDEs, which is the heat conduction equation or diffusion equation. Okay, so, and this essentially just concludes the basic definition of second order PDEs. That is essentially as far as I wanted to go.